Welcome to the Small Business Report. I'm Gordon Deal. We examine things like the minds of entrepreneurs, emerging trends, financing, marketing, unique ideas, big business moves that could affect small businesses, even how to get started on your own. Today's stories, a little-known segment of the wine industry. We'll explain what it's like to be a negociant.
He's in the paint. Down by two. Can he do it? The ball is up. And nothing but net. The crowd goes wild.
Hey, Greg. Waiting on your PC again.
Yep. Want a front row seat to the big game?
No. I'm good.
A workplace that doesn't work is anything but beautiful. Give your employees the power to do their best work and reduce downtime by 50% with new, powerfully performing Dell and Intel technology. Learn more at Dell.com/business.
Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to the state that went from 49th to 10th best in corporate business income tax, where 2,000 burdensome and unnecessary regulations were eliminated over the past 5 years, and is now home to the 6th best entrepreneurial climate. All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice of your business. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Our feature story today is on an entrepreneur named Cameron Hughes, who you may know as a sponsor of our radio program called This Morning, America's First News. He's in the wine business. He basically buys leftover wine from high-end vineyards, swears he'll keep their identity secret, and then puts the wine in his own bottle to sell to consumers at a deep discount. It's a very niche segment of the wine world, and many people have asked me how it works, so we're taking it right to the source. He's the founder of Cameron Hughes Wine and chwine.com and is what's known as a negociant. Cameron, what is a negociant? What does that mean exactly?
Negociant here in California is technically, and it's a bit of a general term, someone who doesn't own vineyards or a winery and is buying wine from other wineries in bulk. In Europe, it means something a little bit different. It means you're not a grape grower. You may have a winery itself and be a negociant. But here in the U.S., it tends to mean someone who buys bulk wine. And don't let the bulk fool you. There's very high-end stuff on there, too. But it's net-net. It's a bulk wine buyer.
All right. And so wineries make too much wine, either, I don't know, for what reason, by accident or bad math, or did you got to get rid of all the grapes somehow?
It's an agricultural product. You never know how much you're going to get.
Okay.
So this year, we actually had a little bit of a short harvest due to pollinization issues in May. And if you have cold weather during April, that can actually inform next year's fruit set and the yields that you get in the vineyard. It's a bit complicated, but again, at the end of the day, it's an agricultural product. Wineries, like we've had 12, 13, and 14 vintages have all been huge quantity and fantastic quality, so there's plenty of wine out there, but we do periodically ebb and flow through shortages.
All right, and so you go to a high-end winery which has a surplus. In other words, the wine has already been made, and this winery
Correct.
Is what, about to dump it? And you buy it?
No. They put it. There is a bulk wine market, and there are brokers. And then, of course, we have a lot of longstanding personal relationships, particularly in Napa Valley. And the wines are sent out to a few choice individuals whose job it is to buy these wines. And wineries buy, sell, and trade amongst themselves all the time. Because at the end of the day, most wines are blends. Even if it's a Cabernet, it's a blend of different Cabernets that were treated with different oak treatments, etc. And so there's component wines that may be 20 barrels of this, 50 barrels of that, that are left out of blends all the time. They're very high quality. They just didn't happen to fit that blend. I will buy that 50 barrels worth of wine, assemble my own blend around that, and bottle it up, and then sell it typically direct to consumer.
Why doesn't the winery make the effort to continue to use its own wine and find other wines to blend?
Yeah, wineries don't like the idea of having second labels, first of all. And as I just said a minute ago, they don't, if they have a component that doesn't fit in, what they don't want to do is go create another label just for that component wine. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Okay. The way the wine business works and how distribution systems work, most wineries want to avoid having a second label. So it just makes a heck of a lot more sense to sell that wine off, collect the cash for it, and move on your merry way. The other thing is most folks want to control their price point. And if you have, suddenly you go from 6,000 cases of $100 bottle Cabernet, which is, by the way, an extremely successful brand, to sell that amount of quantity. And suddenly you've got, you know, over the years, you've got, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 cases worth of grapes harvested each year. There's no way you're going to be able to maintain that price point. And that price point is impossible to get back once you betray it. Okay. So if you start selling wine, you know, on the side at $65 a bottle, then all of a sudden everything comes down to that price point. So in order to preserve and protect that price point, you've got to move your product through the system in a reasonable fashion and without discounting it. So guys would much rather sell the wine out of the back of the winery than try and push it through the front-end branded side of the system, which is a very crowded place to be these days.
Right. We're speaking with Cameron Hughes. He's the founder of Cameron Hughes Wine. Yes, of course, he's a sponsor of the program, but we've gotten a lot of interest in what he does and a lot of questions about how his side of the wine industry works. So we thought, well, why don't we just get him on the horn and let him explain it himself? You have a non-disclosure, too, because you're not allowed to reveal which wineries you go to and negotiate with, correct? Otherwise, what, death by firing squad, or what happens?
Yeah, you're going to get sued. You know, there's a lot of folks. I mean, we buy wine. You know, the price points of wine are all about scarcity. And the guys at the high end, they'll hold inventory forever and ever to make it seem as though you know, they're selling all their $500 a bottle wine really quickly. But the fact of the matter is there's very few brands that can do that. But everybody wants to model that behavior. So, again, in order to protect that price point and make it seem as though everything's moving and that you need to buy this wine as soon as possible, there's just a lot of folks at the very, very high end that want to sell off bulk wine. And obviously, if I'm going out saying, hey, I've got the same wine or a very similar wine in the bottle for one-tenth of the price, that's not going to work out well for them. So obviously we put, and this happens mostly in Napa Valley and then with some super high-end producers around California in other regions. But they just want to protect their name.
All right. I know you didn't stumble into this line of work, but you've been in the wine business for some time, right? Didn't you say like your first job was just slashing boxes and dumping, what was it, Franzia or something like that?
That's right. That was officially my first job in the wine business, was to go out. They were just interesting. So the Franzia box wine program, they had used dates that were hidden, Julian code dates on the box, and they were now going to introduce freshness dating on the top, a bit like Budweiser did, because the product really goes bad after about 9 to 12 months. At least it did back then. I think it's a little bit longer lived these days. But, yeah, that was my first job, was to go take all the out-of-code product, take it to the back of the store, pay for it, and then dump it down the drain. So I actually, my first job in the business was destroying wine, not bottling wine.
And now you rescue it, basically.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a funny you should say that. I used to use that term. We would rescue these small lots of high-end wine. And a lot of these would get purchased by much larger producers and then back-blended. You'd be amazed what 3 to 5% really high-end Cabernet could do to, you know, 100,000 cases of, you know, less expensive or cheap Central Valley stuff. You'd be amazed. And without raising much of the cost basis of that wine. So those silver bullet wines were often being bought, back blended, and we would, quote, come in and rescue them. So, yeah, that's a good phrase.
How difficult was it to launch this business once you made the commitment to go it on your own?
That's a good question. I started putting red blends together back in 2001, so way ahead of my time because that's now the hottest category. But at the time, I just could barely get arrested with this stuff, and I could never get ahead of the cash flow curve. But I had learned enough to be dangerous, and I went to Costco, and I said, hey, I know where all these little small lots of wine are, and I want to design a brand to interface with those one-off opportunities. Maybe it's 1,000 gallons of this or 4,000 gallons of that. And they kind of said, okay, kid, well, don't you drop off a sample? And I did. They loved it. And that's how Cameron Hughes Lot 1 was born. And so that was just a matter of taking the risk and the chance. But then again, I'd spent 2 years, you know, trying to get the business off the ground unsuccessfully previous to that. So, you know, being an entrepreneur is all about taking on the risk, yeah, trying things, not being afraid to fail, and then continuing to kind of tweak your model until you find something that does work.
How'd you pay bills in the meantime?
My wife was living with me, and I actually sold off my wine collection. I had an interwinery discount for 4 or 5 years working for the wine group, where I could go, and this doesn't exist anymore, but all the California wineries, it'd be 30% to 40% off. And so I was buying all these high-end Cabernets out of Napa Valley and storing them. I probably had 40 or 50 cases of these that on winebid.com to help fund the startup of the company.
Wow.
And I just lived off cash flow for a while.
Right. How about that? Very good.
Yeah.
So business now, are you seeing a lot of copycats? Have the copycats always been around? What's, you know, how do you factor in, say, a recovering economy into all this too?
Right, right. We did not invent the Negociant business model by any stretch of the imagination. I think what we did is kind of pull the curtain back and say, look, here's how we do what we do. We're not afraid to admit it. We don't own a winery. We don't own vineyards, but we bring consumers amazing value. And so that part of it has resonated, and other folks have tried to do it. And private label or control labels, which is, I guess, what I do is technically called control label, that has popped up at the retail level quite a bit. So there's competition there. But those folks tend to want to buy lower quality and lower priced wine, whereas I really focus on finding the needle in a haystack. And we do have some competition there, but there's really no brand that has popped up with the transparency of what the Cameron Hughes Lot program does. And I think that's what makes us fairly unique.
Are there folks in the wine industry who don't like what you do? Or are you...
I think there may be... you know, it's funny that I was called a vulture once by another winemaker, but he meant it in a good way.
Okay.
In that, you know, the vulture keeps the ecosystem clean, right? He picks off the things that nobody else needs or wants.
Okay.
Now, we're a very, very high-end vulture, put it that way.
Right.
And so I think everyone who sells me wine very much appreciates me. And I think every time I go around the wine business, everybody's, I love what you do. I think it's brilliant. And there may be some folks, especially after, you know, they've got 40,000 gallons of, say, I just bought Central Coast Pinot for way below the cost of production, simply because they're stuffed full of wine. They don't know what to do with it. And to move that kind of volume through the system, I'm going to have to offer them a low price. So they're not very happy about that. But at the end of the day, they look at it, and if they're smart, they go, all right, that's off our plate.
Yeah.
Let's move forward and continue our business. So I think 99% of the folks in the wine business very much appreciate what we do.
Very good. Who's drinking the most these days? Any particular region of the country or?
Well, for us, it's, you know, it models the top 20 wine consumption markets. So it's California, it's Texas, it's New York, New Jersey, it's Florida, it's Illinois, Massachusetts. You know, those we're shipping all over the country. We can ship legally to about 42 states.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, and that's changed drastically. It was probably 17, 5 to 10 years ago. So the regulatory environment, there's been a sea change there, and that allows us through our chwine.com to reach probably 95% of the wine drinking public.
Wow. Very good. All right, so so thinking perhaps long-term here, it's a question I ask a lot of small business owners. Do you have an exit plan?
No. It's hard to do when your name's on the door, right, and your name's on the label.
Right.
You know, what are you going to do? I think, you know, I love what I do. I love my business. And we'll expand our offering. We're actually going to begin to sell other people's labels on our website, because oftentimes it just doesn't make sense to bring over 200 cases of champagne. Just the label printing, setup charges, et cetera, are cost prohibitive. I'd rather just sell their brand. And there's so many imports that are perfectly happy. They don't care what price you sell it for. As long as they're getting their price out of the cellar, they're not worried about their price point. So, you know, my exit strategy, to answer your question, is to keep doing what I'm doing and do it well. And maybe at some point the company reaches a critical mass where I'm either going to hand it over to my kids, and maybe we'll sell the business. I don't know. I haven't thought that far, Gordon, to be honest with you.
You're you seem to take the packaging / marketing of the delivery pretty seriously. I know, because I've received some of your stuff. It's you know, it's not just some regular old sheet of paper saying thank you. It's kind of a full explanation of what you do. It comes on a thick, you know, a thicker type of paper.
Thick,
you know,
stock.
So explain that. You've paid a lot of attention to detail with that.
Well, I think we do in general, and it shows in the wines. I mean, we're extremely meticulous company, and I want consumers to realize that this is a high-end operation that really believes in luxury products. However, I've always been a consumer first and foremost, and I've always been about value, actually even more first and foremost, and about giving folks a fantastic deal. And that's the only way that a brand like this can operate. When you're selling 40, 50, 60 wines a year, mostly via the internet, and we do still sell a lot of wine through Costco, and we do have retail partners out there as well. Mm-hmm. But our prime business, to launch all those different wines each year, you've really got to over-deliver on quality. And that's really our mission. And as long as we keep doing that, we'll be really fine. But we also want the marketing side to portray that you're really getting a luxury product.
Yeah.
In fact, you go to the former West Coast editor for the Wine Enthusiast just rated all of our wines at stevehymoff.com. We have 92 to 95 point scores for $18 to $35 bottles of wine that anywhere else would be retailing anywhere between $50 and $150 a bottle.
Yeah.
And wine does not cost a lot to make. It costs a lot to sell it. And when we can sell direct to consumer, that enables us, and large quantities to Costco, that enables us to, you know, cut anywhere 50 to 80% off what you'd pay for that under other labels.
It's Cameron Hughes, founder of Cameron Hughes Wine at chwine.com. Back after this.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
Reminder, by the way, you can get more small business reports on our website, which is thismorningwithgordondeal.com. And we encourage you to leave feedback on whatever podcast platform you use, like iTunes or SoundCloud. Again, thismorningwithgordondeal.com. Also, if you'd like to share thoughts or ideas about your small business, send me an email, gdeal@compassmedianetworks.com. Again, gdeal@compassmedianetworks.com. Thanks for listening to the Small Business Report. I'm Gordon Deal.